This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I feel really lucky to have been able to come back to San Diego, where the company gave me some of my first chances to spread my wings as a director. Reviving Francesca's production over the years, I took a number of different singers through it. And now we have LaTanya Moore, who sings from her soul. Puccini would have ravished and written three more operas for her had he heard her voice. She just finds her way into the rubato and the nuance, the crescendos, and the text just comes alive for her, and you believe her.
Any girl can relate to Cho Cho San is, you know, kind of falling in love for the first time. When you're that young, like, emotions run wild in a way. And you see this, you see somebody that's really, you know, good looking, debonair, and you fall fast. In that way, I can definitely relate. And she's also a girl who's, like, got a really, I think, a vivid imagination. You know what I mean? And the way she speaks is so just, I don't know, very attractive. You know, like any teenage girl would speak to someone that she's trying to impress. So that's exactly how I was when I was younger, too, trying to impress a guy. I don't know if I can relate to, you know, her situation. I've never been put in that situation. And if I was, I know I would have reacted differently. But, I mean, any woman in a desperate situation, even if they wouldn't make the same choices, can somehow relate.
One of my favorite moments, it's in the act two, when she's singing her aria, which I believe is one of the most beautiful ever written for soprano.
There are places where you need to understand that this opera is not always operatic, that a lot of it sometimes is almost like recitative in a way, almost like a play. You know, even Un bel di vedremo, such a famous aria, is not really an aria. It's just spoken words. She's just storytelling, text painting. Once you get, you know, emotionally into it, oh, it's so hard to keep your throat in check and to keep your heart in check, but maybe sometimes that's not the worst thing, you know. This opera changed completely for me once I had a daughter. When I was younger and I was doing Madame Butterfly, I'd almost laugh at all the chicks that were crying at the end, you know what I mean, and just feeling so emotionally just, you know, overwhelmed. Because I was just like, no, come on, it's acting. You have to keep it in check, you know. You may be doing one thing on the outside, but it has to be different on the inside. when you have a child, you can't separate it. I can't say the words that Cho-Cho-San says and completely separate myself from them, because it's just impossible. It's a physical thing that you can feel, you know, your child being ripped away in some way, and I don't know if I could bear it. And vocally, definitely at the beginning of this process, I really couldn't bear it. You know, it's very hard. This is one of the first real productions of Madame Butterfly that I've done since I've had her, other than one performance. But other than that, this is the first one. So I am still finding my way emotionally. You know, it's going to take time, I think, for me to get where I want. But it added such a depth that I didn't have for the character before. So I'm grateful for her for it, for many things, but definitely for that.
Because I want this music
so,
to feel
what
awkward.
Should I do with this?
I want it to feel awkward.
This, music.
This is where I want awkward.
Exactly.
I don't know what to do.
We have a long way to go in this duet.
Yeah. Yes. So this place feels awkward.
He's young and inexperienced. He's a bit ignorant, unfortunately. And unfortunately for her, I believe that he doesn't want to think in advance about what is going to happen next. He doesn't care. This is the biggest mistake he's doing. He feels compassion for her. In this set, he tries somehow to help her, but he just can't do it, because the guilt is too strong. So he decides to leave the place, and then when he's coming back, because he's coming back, it's already too late. There are so many beautiful moments. When I'm on the stage, my favorite moment it's the love duet, because he's really in love with her here. He's tender, he's sweet, and she's amazing too. Special evening, special moments for her and for him too.
As far as to call him a jerk. Perhaps he was just the typical male of that time. I guess the way I see somebody like Pinkerton is I had to look at it like, what if that was somebody in my own family and this happened to him? I wouldn't necessarily think my brother was a jerk for doing something like this. You know what I mean? But what makes him so human is the remorse behind it. It's really a terrible remorse. It's really heartbreaking to me when I see something like that. You see many times people boo Pinkerton. Don't boo him. He made a gigantic mistake that he thought that would never come back to bite him. And it does, in the worst way possible.
Is he a villain? No. Is he naive? A little bit. Is he careless? Absolutely.
Relationship between them, if you might think about it this way, two men that went to Yale and were roommates together but ended up on the opposite spectrum of society. Not, you know, not in that way, but like John Kerry and George Bush. You know what I mean? They're very different. They have a lot of the same principles, but they're very different in the way they go about achieving, you know, implementation of that into society. You know, one does things on a whim and one doesn't. One's more thoughtful. He's very, you know, taken aback by this one teenage girl. He more or less is befuddled by this one person, and it's making him not able to do his job or do his duty to Pinkerton and Goro and all those guys, and Yamadori, all the other people he's trying to help. She wasn't just, you know, like we are as Americans, Pinkerton and myself, we're very inauthentic, I guess, is the way he's trying to put that. And she's more of a real person. Puccini is not extremely fond of giving the baritone a lot of amazing things to do, but he does give all of his baritone characters much, much, much character. And what I mean by that is he gives you a lot to think about and do and show to the audience as a baritone, but he might not give you an aria. He's going to give that to the soprano and the tenor, or the, you know, the great duet or something like that. But I look at it as it's more a part of the story and not kind of the star of the show. It's what moves the train along.
Suzuki's role in the opera is very crucial, actually. She is Chocho-san's maid, but along with that, she's her best friend. She's one of her only friends. And so they're kind of like sister figures.
There are a few dramatic and vocal challenges in the role of Suzuki. One of them being that she doesn't actually sing a lot, but she's always on stage. So dramatically, it's a bit of a challenge to always stay in it when you're not singing, and I think probably most singers would agree with that. However, it's really rewarding because Suzuki, when she's not singing, she's doing a lot of the emotional work. And so it's crucial to always pay attention to her because of that. Also, what's a bit challenging is when she does sing, often it's kind of interjections. And so it's like, okay, I really got to be on it, which is a great challenge. But it's very different than, you know, singing an aria or a duet or a set piece of music all the time. Garnett, I love his process. He gives you kind of an idea of what he wants, and he lets you fill in the blanks. And so that's really cool. I like that style of working.
If you could actually at this point come from the downstage, we're going to have to open both of these doors.
Oh, okay.
I know I said they would stay solid for that one, but now they're changing. Suzuki will just appear in this entryway. Mm-hmm. All right.
I came to theater because I love collaboration, and I don't need to have all the good ideas. I have some. I'm happy to provide them, but I want people to feel invested in the process. So I encourage them to talk about their experiences or their approach to the character, and we figure out what they do well, what they want to do better, and we encourage them to listen to one another.
So the perpetual, we're getting ready for bed. And then you will unbutton your jacket.
Okay.
I think we're going to keep. Well, we'll see. I mean, I think you're in your row, but I think that he's trying to make the point of let's move this
let's
to second base.
Deflower you.
It might be a little vulgar. I don't know.
Isn't that what it is? Literally
deflower. Beautiful words.
So I find it's an efficient way to pull a cast together and get them around a shared goal and a shared idea. And that way, those friendships, those bonds, those conversations help them make sure this production feels different than the last one they did, if it's their first one. It gives them places to keep asking questions of themselves and the characters in the moments as they observe them on stage. We've been doing a production that was set in a U.S. consulate's office for three performances. So now we go back to the shoes and the obi and the kimono and the parasols. And to not make them caricature, but there are things in terms of the gesture and posture that we're working with the chorus now, and, you know, how they hold their hands. And there are a number of options to do it, but we shouldn't be distracting. We're not going to have Italian hands all over the place. That there's a reserve, that there is a focus, there's a bit of meditation that happens with these characters.
As we're coming up out of the bow, Gran Ventura, if we had a little sly smile before Rigo Renza, or a little sort of eyebrow moment, if the head's tilted just a little bit, we all want to get a better look at Pinkerton and his buddies down here. So it's, again, finding that moment in the characterization. You know, the places where we can look and there's a little bit of mystery, right? The same thing, you know, as you're opening the parasols back there, it's not a technical thing, it's a mysterious thing. It's part of the show. It's part of the performance. And the closing of them is part of the performance as well.
Even though we really have a decorative chorus, the chorus functions in many ways in a manner, I think, that's a little bit similar to Verdi's Rigoletto. By that I mean that the chorus actually functions as an antagonist in the drama. the butterfly is really the only one who believes that it's really true love. In the brief choral moments of Act One, we hear the whispers, the gossip of the chorus.
Cho-cho-san! Cho-cho-san!
And then, as the bonds comes in after the wedding and tells everyone on stage that Cho-cho-san has renounced the Shinto religion, we renounce her. We curse her. And that's really what sets, in my mind, what sets up the immense drama of Act Two. The humming chorus is interesting in that it's a totally wordless chorus, obviously. Here we are representing the chirping of the crickets, the night insects, the songs of the night. And really, humming chorus is one of those moments that is actually vital to Puccini's conception of Madame Butterfly to begin with. It's actually quite a difficult chorus to pull off well. If it's done correctly, the audience is totally unaware of the difficulty that it takes to put it all together.
Okay, 116.
There's a lot to listen to. the first thing is getting a real feel for the characters, getting the understanding of the portrayal of this American captain or soldier, representing in a way the iconic American who travels the world and lands in different lands and has adventures. And then immediately moves on to next flower, so to speak.
Sono in questo paese, elastici del barcase contratti. L'uomo esperto ne profitta, certo.
The contrast side of that is Butterfly and all her incredible sensitivity and sensibility, trapped in a way in this world of rigid structure that was Japan at that time. Thank you. So there you have two sides. You have this freedom of the American, and you have that rigid structure of the Japanese. And those two worlds are going to come colliding together to create something that we don't really know what it's going to happen. But like in all tragedies, it cannot end well. Anybody listening to that music for the first time can capture already, having not even heard another opera before, that trajectory of these characters. To me, it's a little bit like Star Wars. Star Wars, to me, is like an opera. I mean, it's, you know, it's multi-generational, it's epic in its proportions. This may not be epic in that sense, but it has that same similar sense of the bad guy and the good guy, and then something happens that creates death and destruction.
Tanya Moore just sounds divine. She is Cho-Cho-San. And for me, it's the voice that you want to hear singing this role. The set design is absolutely gorgeous, and it takes you off to a whole different land. It's Puccini. For me, I mean, it's the best of Puccini.
It's one of those operas that tugs at your heartstrings so hard that you can't deny it, even if you're not an opera lover. But the story is just, I mean, it's just heartbreaking. Really, even if you're into all the pop music in the world, when you hear something like this, it just does something different to you. You know, it just, I don't know, it opens you up like a flower, you know what I mean? It opens all of us up. But I think it's the story, you know, the tragedy of it, and just how sweet it all starts out and how it goes kaboom in the end. Everybody falls for a story like that, myself included.
Who was he? Is that a test? Okay, we're starting from the beginning. Here we go. Are you ready?
Been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.